military intervention because it wasn't clear how the situation would develop. You're listening to the news on RTHK.
Good morning. Welcome to Money for Nothing. I'm Brian Curtis. Well, Spain becomes the fourth European country to seek a bailout. China's trade numbers surprise to the upside, and the socialists look set to win the most seats in the French elections. Full details coming up shortly and a discussion. Our market guests this morning include Mark Conan, CEO of Cathay Conning Asset Management, and RTHK's economics correspondent Barry Wood. Then later in our industry segment, we will take a look at publishing with James Ross of Lightning International, David Smith, chairman of the industry group SOPA, and Denise Jung, a senior reporter at the South China Morning Post. Well, the traders look to be in control today. At least today, it looks like kicking the can down the road is a good thing. Markets are higher. There's green numbers on the screens. So at least temporarily, all appears to be well. Australian market has moved to the upside, 0.8%. So pretty strong rally in the ASX 200, up 35 points at 4,107. And looking at the euro, it has made some big gains against the dollar, up to 1.264 U.S. dollars. That's a jump of about 1.5%. The dollar is now at 79.54 yen. And oil prices also jumped quite significantly, up more than 2.6%. Brent crude up 261 to 102.08. So what it means is risk on is back on today, at least as I mentioned, for the moment. Well, let's get to some of this news flow for you. Spain becoming the fourth euro member to seek a bailout. The prime minister is calling it a victory, but few will probably see it in that light. Spain is requesting 100 billion euros to rescue its banks. More now from the BBC's Gavin Hewitt.
Internationally, there has been relief that Spain's banks are to get a rescue. The view is that one of the Eurozone's biggest risks has been reduced. In Spain itself, the reaction has been much more cautious. There has been criticism of the Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, for not making the announcement himself that the country's banks were to have access to loans of up to 100 billion euros. 10 days ago, he said there would be no rescue of Spanish banks. Today, he decided to face the press and defended the rescue as the right thing to do.
Ayer ganó.
If the government hadn't taken the steps it had, he said, we would have been asking for a bailout, not just of the banks, but for the Kingdom of Spain. Yesterday, he said, the currency of the euro won. Yesterday, the future of the euro won. But he struck a more somber note too. Spain would stay in recession this year and next, and more Spaniards would lose their job in a country where one in four is already unemployed. What the rescue will do is to buy time. The European Commission believes it will help prevent contagion to other vulnerable countries like Italy. It should, in the short term, reduce the country's borrowing costs and make it easier to access credit. But this is not a lasting fix. These loans will be added to Spain's total debt. House prices are still falling, increasing the number of bad loans. There are other difficulties on the horizon, like how to finance Spain's troubled regions. But the biggest challenge for Spain and for the Eurozone is how to rekindle growth.
So you never know how the markets will interpret these stories and these developments. As I mentioned, at least today, it looks like the markets are embracing them. But the BBC's Robert Peston says, although it might calm fears for a time, it's unlikely to sustain confidence.
It would be surprising if markets didn't react positively to the news that the Eurozone will lend 100 billion euros to the Spanish government so that it can strengthen its financially overstretched banks. But since investors have been discounting such a rescue, you never can tell. They may choose instead to focus on the considerable uncertainties and negatives associated with the bailout. First, Spain, which is already struggling to reduce a substantial deficit, would be adding debt equivalent to 10% of its economic output or GDP to its already sharply rising national debt. Second, by bailing out banks through semi or total nationalisations, the government is enlarging the perceived liabilities of the state by assuming responsibility for banks, huge liabilities. Third, if the bailout loan were to rank ahead of existing private sector loans to the Spanish government, there's a risk that Spain would end up paying more to borrow from conventional commercial sources, which is precisely the opposite of what it wanted. So although Spain hopes it will avoid the stigma of being classed as a failed economy by allocating all the bailout funds to its banks, it may not enjoy that luxury.
And El País is reporting that Spain will pay an interest rate of 1% for this European aid. That's substantially lower than what it has to pay in the open markets. At the last auction, bids are up around 6.5% for 10-year notes. Well, let's take a brief look at France before we get to our guest this morning and the pithy comment on a Monday. French President François Hollande's Socialist Party is set in the French parliamentary elections to win a majority. Exit polls are showing that the Socialist Party and its Green and Left Front allies took 47.1% of the vote. Former President Nicolas Sarkozy's Union for a Popular Movement and its allies got 35.4%. Mr. Hollande will now have to wait until the June 17th second round to know if he has an absolute majority or if he will need allies in Parliament. Mr. Hollande needs control of the lower house to push through his proposals on growth. Well, joining us on the program now for discussion about these markets and developments over the weekend, Barry Wood, our economics correspondent, and Mark Conan, CEO of Cathay Conning Asset Management. Good morning, gents.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, Mark, if I could go to you first. First, your take on this bailout request by Spain.
Well, it immediately gets Spain off the broiler and calms markets down. The cost of borrowing for the Spanish government had started to reach the levels where the debt overhang was seen as being unsustainable. By agreeing to take this loan, the government effectively sees its way clear, probably for another 12 months, being able to finance its own debt requirements, which are actually quite low when you take out the banking problem.
We've seen these respites before, and they don't last too long. We've moved all the way through the pigs, except for the one of the eyes, Italy. Is Italy in the sights next, or is it in relatively better shape?
Well, certainly immediately, by calming markets over Spain, borrowing costs for all those endangered economies will start to ease. The question is whether or not these austerity measures are really realistic, because Spain has been the dutiful student in terms of the Eurozone and has taken them and put in place these austerity measures and vowed to put in the reforms, unlike Greece, which seems to waver week by week. The question is whether or not that's realistic with such a high level of unemployment, and clearly the economy is becoming less competitive and is shrinking at 2% this year. So if Spain can't come to terms with the economic fundamentals, then it will knock on, and Italy is next in sight.
And, you know, you might think that this calms the waters for only a few days, because we have a very important vote coming up this Sunday in Greece, also in France. But the more dedicated focus will probably be in Greece. Barry, are you expecting things not to go the way that some expect in Greece?
Well, I do think that in the end, the people are going to pull back from voting for Syriza. That's the far-left party that wants to alter the Troika's plan of austerity but still keep the euro. I think that in the end, people will go back to these discredited but more well-known parties. But we shall see. I think anything could happen.
Yeah, that's really, that's hoping, that's hopium, I guess. To me, it seems like, you know, this is a little bit of a special deal for Spain, and the other countries in the periphery are not likely to be very happy, although I haven't seen anything yet, but I would assume they would not be that pleased.
You mean not very pleased with the Spanish bailout, because
yes,
the Spanish government didn't have to go to the IMF as well as to the European Stability Mechanism?
Yes, and by billing this as a more of a bank bailout, even the Prime Minister said in his news conference, well, it's a big victory because it's simply for the banks, not for the country, therefore he doesn't lose any sovereignty
yeah,
in Brussels.
That's true, Brian, but I don't think very many people in Spain believe that this is a victory for the euro, or for that matter, a victory for Mr. Rajoy's government. I think they would smile or even throw a shoe at the television as they heard that. But the fact is, as Mark said at the beginning, Spain has been a very good student. Spain has taken the austerity measures. It has cut back in a lot of ways. It has won a lot of praise from international officials in Europe and here in Washington at the IMF. So the fact that they've avoided going to the IMF, this is what the ESM was all about. This is the firewall. But this does not mean that they may have to go to the IMF later on. We'll have to see. I don't see how they're going to get any growth, as Mark suggested. I mean, this is the problem. They're taking the austerity measures. They're bailing out their banks. The euro's up. That's all good news, but it doesn't really solve an underlying problem.
Mark, what does this mean for the investment market? So we mentioned that today things seem to have calmed down a little bit. Well, you could say markets have been oversold. Does it last, in your view?
No, it doesn't last, I'm afraid. I think at each stage of these bailouts, as they're announced, and every set of new measures, the markets suddenly get a little bit more excited and relieved, and there's a small reaction, and that reaction gets smaller every time. I think the bigger issue on how this whole debt issue, debt situation in Europe still needs to be addressed, and unfortunately, policymakers find it very difficult to come to terms with what needs to be done and are always at least two steps behind the curve. And, you know, we talk economics, but it really is embroiled in a political saga across the continent, and we've already seen a number of governments get unseated. We've seen technocratic governments put in place undemocratically and without some clear leadership and clear vision, which we don't have at the moment. I think this is going to continue.
For a while, we had a little bit of clear vision on austerity. It didn't seem to be working, but it was there because there was a strong alliance between Germany and France. It seems like that alliance, that core alliance, has been broken a bit. Does that make it much more complicated going forward?
Well, certainly questionable, but I think the bigger issue, which you allude to, austerity itself, is just not sustainable. Austerity works very well on paper, but Spain is the great example. It's taken the medicine, put in place the measures, and yet the economy is still shrinking and it's becoming less competitive. So I think that's proof enough that the measures on their own don't solve the problem. As we know, as the economy gets smaller, the debt gets bigger as a percentage of GDP. And if you look at what's going on in Spain with the overhang of the property sector, 37% of GDP in property loans, a million units at risk. These are big, big numbers, and you know, let's not forget, Spain is almost twice the size of the other three ailing economies added together.
Okay, let's hold on for just a moment. I wanted to do a little bit of news about China and its trade numbers over the weekend, then we'll come back for some discussion. China's exports grew in May at more than double the pace of estimates, so that was being seen by many as good news. Shipments up 15% from the year earlier, and that, interestingly enough, beat out all 29 estimates in a Bloomberg survey. Industrial output rose by less than 10% for the second month, and retail sales increased the least in almost 6 years, excluding seasonal distortion. So that wasn't seen as such. But the trade numbers said to be showing surprising resilience, and analysts say it might indicate that the debt crisis in Europe is not having as strong an effect on global commerce as the 2008 crisis did. The latest numbers might suggest also a more restrained stimulus from the Chinese authorities. Andrew Polk, the China economist of the research firm The Conference Board in Beijing, was asked by my colleague if he was surprised by yesterday's trade figures.
The trade figures were definitely much better than we expected, driven especially by a strong uptick to growth to exports to the U.S., which was a good thing. And exports to the EU actually expanded year on year, so showed some stabilization. The thing that people need to keep in mind is that this, you know, a one-month uptick may or may not be sustained going forward. So it's not a 100% done deal that it will continue expanding.
Andrew Polk from the Conference Board there in Beijing. So, Mark Conan, can we take it that although there is this financial crisis, this debt crisis in Europe, that it's not having quite as big an impact on global trade as it could, referencing these China numbers as an example?
Well, we still haven't reached the point where the European economy sort of falls off the wagon and hits global trade to the extent that we saw the slump back in 2008. So it's probably a little bit too early to call that one. I think what the numbers in China are showing more significantly, I think, is that the inflation situation is starting to come under control. We saw amongst the set of data, inflation, core inflation coming down about 3 percentage points, and that's why we saw the interest rate cut, both borrowing and lending. The trade picture was better than expected, and I think if you dig away through those numbers, you'll see that some of the measures China's been taking in recent years to diversify its trade globally, both in terms of type of activity but also in destination, are starting to prove somewhat effective. But the external environment is very important, and if Europe does hit a slump, it will affect this region, and in particular will hit China.
And Barry, does it tell you that the U.S. economy is, although it's growing slowly, that it is at least growing, and, you know, it's not so likely to tip back into recession?
Yes, I think it absolutely says that, because you can't have this kind of a rally as we saw on Wall Street this week. I mean, after all, we're up 435 points. I mean, this is a very significant rally. I'm not saying that the correction that we've had in the month of May is over, but I would think that if you're an optimist, you'd say, I think it is. But I do think that the fact that the economy is growing, housing is indeed bottoming and beginning to turn up, I think things look pretty good here in the States.
So why are people like Mohammed El-Erian at PIMCO so nervous and so negative? He talks about debt ballooning to more than $40 trillion worldwide and it being a synchronized slowdown.
Well, I think he is aware that the American public hasn't come to terms with the fact that we seem to be growing at a 1 to 2% rate when we're used to really a 3 to 5% rate. And I think that that kind of slow recovery from a global delevering is a problem, and I think that that is the simple reality. But I would point to a couple things I don't think Mr. El-Erian has yet spoken about. He's certainly aware of them. I mean, we've got a very sharp decline in oil prices. That's good for the American consumer and the American car buyer, the traveler. And I think the fact that the dollar has come up helps the Europeans. I don't think Germany is going to fall into recession, so I think that we'll muddle along. But it is a muddle. It's not a very fast growth, but it is a recovery from a very serious debt crisis.
All right, Barry, thanks very much for being with us here on this Monday morning. Barry Wood, our economics correspondent based in the United States, in the Washington area, and Dr. Mark Conan, CEO of Cathay Conning Asset Management. Mark, thanks very much for coming in. We'll take this short break, and then we talk about publishing and whether or not newspapers will stop printing anytime soon.
If a fire breaks out in your building, stay calm. If you decide to leave, carry your keys, mobile phone, and a towel, and use the nearest stairway. If there is smoke in the stairway, use a towel to cover your nose and mouth and try another stairway. If there's also smoke in the other stairway, return to your home immediately. Close the door and seal it with tape and towels and call 999 for help.
Just for fun, before more of the serious discussion, we go back to Clark and Daw from the ABC.
Mr. Howe's argument is that by failing to lower interest rates, you're sending jobs overseas.
Well, that's not an argument. That's finger-painting. Mr. Howes might know what he's talking about in other areas, but he makes quite a common error here in assuming that if you lower interest rates, Brian, you reduce upward pressure on the exchange rate. What happens if you lower interest rates is that people spend more, and ultimately you've got to put interest rates up.
So can you make any argument work as a justification what you've already done?
What a very flattering and kind person you are. That's a lovely thought, Brian. But actually my job is to use the levers and controls at our disposal to best benefit the Australian economy.
Yes, by what criteria?
By the criteria we're given.
That is why Mr. Howes is saying the RBA charter needs to be reviewed.
Well, that would be a matter for government.
So he should talk to the government?
Yeah, I mean, someone would need to make an appointment, obviously.
Mr. Howes making an appointment.
No. The government, Brian, would need to make an appointment with Mr. Howes. He's a pretty important bloke.
Extremely important.
You're not going to get in easily. I don't know how they'd get in.
Not this year.
No, not this year. He's a very, very important man. They might be able to see his assistant.
Yeah, in a couple of years.
Yes, whoever he might be.
Thanks for your time.
He'd need one, though. He's a very busy bloke. Thank you, Brian. I'm disappointed we've had to come to such an early conclusion.
It was most illuminating.
Seemed to be going so well.
Yeah, more stimulating business talk here on Radio 3. This is Money for Nothing. I'm Brian Curtis, 22 minutes after 8 o'clock. Well, a few weeks ago, the New York Times created a bit of a stir, saying that the New Orleans Times-Picayune would start issuing a print edition only 2 to 3 times a week. The New York Times itself has said that there will come a day when they limit or even stop publishing. And we've heard some analysts in the industry say that 2017 is perhaps a year when, you know, you won't really see printed newspapers around much. So if you're listening to this program, obviously you get your news and information, at least some of it, from Radio 3. But where else? TV, online? Well, we look at publishing with our contributor, James Ross, CEO of Lightning International, also joined by David Smith, chairman of the industry group SOPA, and Denise Zhang, an award-winning senior business reporter at the South China Morning Post. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Let me just throw this question to David Smith first. I know you've handed out the awards last week, and there was some, I'm sure, some excellent, outstanding pieces and reporters that, you know, that ran away with the awards, Denise being one of them. But from the way that you handed out the awards, does it tell you anything about the latest trends in the industry?
Actually, I think the industry is still doing very, very well. I think the awards this year was a great example of that. We had an increase in the number of entries by 20% over last year. There seems to be a wider, people wanting to recognize excellence in journalism, and I think that's one of the key things, is because journalism today is really crucial into determining the success of publications and newspapers and magazines and whatnot going forward. So I do see the industry as being strong. It's a very interesting time to be in the industry at the moment with the advent of digital and online, as we see publishing moving to those platforms. So I don't see it at all as a negative. I see it as a positive.
Yeah, we sort of have to look at it the same way in the radio industry. But James, as you look at this, I mean, do you agree that it's really all about the journalism? It's all about the stories. It's not so much about the method of delivery.
Well, I think as we all know that content is king, and that's really what drives people. But certainly the printed word is still out there. You know, we see it the free newspapers at the MTR stations, we see magazines everywhere, the number of titles, glossy titles coming out last year, I think we just noted was actually up last year. So, there's a lot of optimism. But I guess, David, does that translate into money?
Yes, I think for some it does. I think it depends on the publication. I think organizations that are just reporting hard news these days are facing tough times, because it's increasingly easy to find hard news out there on multiple places. I think publishers these days have to figure out how to differentiate, how to really figure out what their audience is looking for, and increasingly it's more about opinion analysis and those types of commentary that are really drawing in the readers and keeping them loyal.
And local news. Exactly. I note that Warren Buffett was moving on some local newspapers, and people thought, what is he crazy? But if you think about it, it's sort of monopoly business almost. The South China Morning Post has the Standard to compete with, but in a lot of places there's one big daily newspaper, and they do provide something that you can't really get elsewhere so much online, which is really good, hardcore local news.
Yes.
And Denise, do you see it that way? I mean, you're a local business reporter, and tell us briefly what you won for as well.
Well, basically, I write for microeconomics, trade and manufacturing activities in the PRD, that is the factory of the world, and with a focus on China. The award-winning stories were all focusing on this area. And just tied to the trade figures that you mentioned earlier, that we have all these hard figures, but what really happening down to the factory floor? So we try to go to the factories, talk to managers, talk to migrant workers to see what the real picture is. So this is some types of stories that readers are interested, because other than hard figures, we need something to illustrate the situation in an entertaining way, or in a more easier way to read the stories. And especially right now, things are changing very fast. As James earlier mentioned, that you know, content is king. Content is still king, you know, and a newspaper, especially for SMP, that has published for 110 years. So we keep it of how to do business, how to do news. And now the trend is shifting to a more proactive way to look for news rather than waiting at the newsroom for things to happen.
So it seems that feature content, that deeper content, is really what people are after.
Absolutely.
Does that enterprise reporting?
It is, yeah. We spend more time to look for ideas of our own just to differentiate with other newspapers. For example, we look at companies in terms of profiles and look at people in news just to tell readers more about the context and background about things.
And is that what advertisers, David, is that what advertisers want? You look after advertising and sponsorship for The Economist as your daytime job.
Right, that's right. Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think advertisers are looking for different ways to engage with the audiences that they're targeting. And they do that, they can do that, they can come to publishers like ourselves and others to find out creative ways to do that. So yes, the content is very, very important as far as drawing the audience in, but then ways to maximize that the advertising to how to connect with them is the key challenge these days. I think it's very, very important to do.
And the online component, obviously we're seeing a lot of publishing moving to some extent from print to online. Is it possible to charge people for that content? I know that, you know, News Corp has been looking at doing that around the world with some of its sites. You know, the SCMP runs a paid site for that people have to pay for to get the deeper content. Is that a successful model? Are we going to see more of that going forward, do you think?
Absolutely. I think you definitely have to charge people for the content that you're producing, or else we'll all be out of business.
I don't think it's going to work. I think, you know, we pay with attention. And, you know, as soon as you – I think the SCMP has been held back a lot by its subscription firewall. And good luck.
I think it's a balance. I think you have to strike a balance. I think there's some content that obviously should be premium and behind a paywall, and there's other content that could be free to the general public. And I know the way we do things at The Economist is a little different, where we keep the paper, the content that's in the newspaper every week, as a premium. However, the paper, the magazines in the newspaper, is only about 50% of the content that's on the website. There's blogs and there's all sorts of content that's on there available for free. So I think there's different models, and I think everyone has to figure out what's the right model, really.
Okay, well, thanks very much, guys, for coming in. Appreciate the insights, and these congratulations on your award.
Thanks very much.
It was excellence in business reporting. Denise Jung is the senior business reporter for Saturday Morning Post, and David Head is the chairman of SOPA, the Society of Publishers, and head of advertising and sponsorship for The Economist.
And James, thank you very much. James Ross there, Lightning International.
Thank you.
We'll leave you with weather today. Mainly cloudy, some showers expected, some isolated thunderstorms, 31 degrees as the maximum. Money for Nothing at 8:30. The news with Samantha.
Thousands of people have taken part in a protest march to demand a thorough investigation into the death of the mainland dissident Li Wangyang. Organisers said 25,000 people were involved in the march to the central government's liaison office in Weston. Police put the figure at 5,400. The demonstrators, mostly dressed in black, said they didn't believe Mr. Li committed suicide, as the authorities in Shaoyang insisted. More than 30 different organisations took part. The event spokeswoman Crystal Chow urged local delegates to the nation's top advisory body, the CPPCC, including incoming chief executive CY Leung, to reflect the people's call for a fair investigation to Beijing.
It's a matter of our conscience. I think all human mankind on this world have to look into such mysterious and suspicious death. We are gathering people here today to express our anger and our concern over this matter. At least we think our chief executive has the responsibility to express our thoughts and our anger towards this matter.
Exit polls in France suggest President François Hollande will have a socialist-led majority in Parliament. The second decisive round of the parliamentary election takes place next week. From Paris, here's the BBC's Christian Fraser.
Another good night for the socialists in France, with the new president François Hollande consolidating his grip on power. The vote means the socialists will control the lower house for the first time in 10 years, though the low turnout perhaps denied the new president a bigger triumph. The big story of the night was once again the performance of the National Front. Marine Le Pen's party took 14% of the vote, up from 4% in 2007. The far right has not had seats in Parliament since the 1980s. The electoral system may yet deny the National Front a seat, but by some margin, they are now the third biggest in France.
Fresh details are emerging of fierce clashes between opposition fighters and Syrian government forces in the capital, Damascus, on Friday. A power station was attacked, leaving areas of the city without electricity for several hours, and a bus carrying Russian oil workers was reportedly hit. Casualty figures aren't known. You're listening to the news on RTHK.